Good morning, everybody. It's WMFO Medford. I'm Mike. How you doing right now? Stay tuned because we have a live edition of Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico right here at WMFO. And we're back. Welcome to Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. It's another live episode at WMFO in Medford. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. It's great to be back here with our friend Mike Newman handling the board. I want to publicly thank you, Mike and Destiny Costas, for filling in for me last week and interviewing Terry O'Malley from Stop Calling Me Frank, the lovable Terry O'Malley. You guys were pretty good, man. I think I'll have you guys back as guest hosts.
Well, thanks, Steve. It was really fun, and we look forward to doing more.
Soft-spoken Mike Newman.
Am I?
Yes.
Oh.
No, really, seriously, I really enjoyed it. I know a lot of people heard it, and they were a little confused at first, but they figured it out.
We appreciate the opportunity, Steve. Thank you.
Of course, we have a special guest with us here on Blowing Smoke, as we usually do. Boston garage rock royalty in the house, Cam Acklin from the legendary Prime Movers is here. How are you, my friend?
Very good, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. You're too kind, as always, Steve.
Before we get into it, though, what about the Celtics, man? Because I know you're a Celtics fan, too. We liked that, didn't we?
Love it. I love it. I don't know what Steve Kerr's problem is with Team USA.
Oh, that's lame.
Tatum would be dropping 60 on the Warriors next time, first time we play them. So, but meanwhile, who cares? Love the C's.
Yeah, you know, I'm still celebrating the championship, and we're in August. I can't stop celebrating. So the reason why Cam's here is this is exciting news. The Prime Movers are doing a reunion show Saturday, September 14th at the Burn, Davis Square, Somerville, one of the coolest places around, which is right down the road from here. Yeah. Cam, of course, is the singer of the Prime Movers, along with original. He'll be with original band members that night. Guitarist Dick Tate, who was almost here today, but maybe next time.
Missed us by that much.
Yeah. And of course, my good friend, your good friend, everyone's good friend, Dennis McCarthy, who's out in Pittsburgh, PA. And Greg Steinbaugh is filling in on bass for the late Jeff Sugarman, who sadly left us in 2012. It's been like a few years.
Yes.
Who was the original bassist. Now, you and Greg played together in Port Charles Quintet, so.
We did. And Dennis and Greg played together prior to that in World's Greatest Sinners, which Dennis was doing with his girlfriend at the time, Jordan Valentine. And through that, Greg used to sub in for Jeffrey for the last few years. The Movers were playing in that last go-around, 2009, 2010. When Jeff was busy, Greg would sub. So he's filled in multiple times, and he's an extended member of the family. We're really glad to have him. He was actually the instigator for this whole get-together on the 14th.
That's what I hear.
Yeah, it was his idea. You couldn't leave well enough alone, so here we are.
Well, I'm excited, okay, because I haven't seen the Prime Movers in a long time. When you guys did get back together for a little while and do some shows around 2006, 2007, I didn't get to see the band then.
You know, we were playing for several years, and it started as, like, I think a one-off at the East in 2001, and then slowly it just kind of... Martin Doyle was booking the Overdraft down on Cambridge Street. He used to actually call me. You know, we really didn't plan on, okay, we're getting back together. We played a show. We played another show. Then all of a sudden, Martin would be, and I mean, when's the last time the guy from the club was calling you or calling me? He would call me up and say, hey, you want to play Saturday night? Yada. Made it so easy. We started playing more, and it just kind of snowballed in. We played several years. It's a lot of fun for the most part. We made the recording with Jack, which was awesome.
Yeah.
And that was really fun.
We're
going to
talk about that for
sure. Yeah. And then we hit Europe, got that off our list, something we always wanted to do. And then we said, all right, we'll see you later. We took a little break again. So here we are. It was 15 years. And who's to say when comes down the road again. So we're really excited. And I would encourage everyone who wants to see it to come out and see it, because who's to say when
it will
happen
there this
again.
Time. Yeah. When you did it last time, I was in California, so I missed it. But That was a good name drop, Martin Doyle. I love when his name gets dropped. He was actually really the first booking agent of the Middle East when Billy Ruane started The Room. Wasn't he the first booking agent there?
You know, I don't know. I remember Greg Kendall. I remember Skeggy doing shows too. He was a collective effort. I'm not sure.
But Martin's been like a million clubs.
You know how it is, right?
The Causeway. Remember the Causeway?
Sure. The usual suspects always pop up, you know?
Yeah, well, that's good, man. I got to talk to Martin. I haven't talked to him in a long time. But before we get a little current, I want to go way back. Now, I know a lot of stuff started happening around 83 for you guys. When did the band actually form? And tell us how the band formed, how you guys got it going.
Again, it was all just coincidence. I wound up at the same high school as Richard and Jeff. We met each other. Dick was wearing fry boots and flared jeans trying to figure out how to play Cinnamon Girl the first time I ever saw him. And I was like, oh, look at that guy with the guitar. But we
which high school is this?
Newton South, to tell
Newton
tell
South
tales.
High
yeah,
School.
Newton South High School. And so we were all hanging around, not really doing much school. But you know, Richard had a basement and an older brother who played guitar, who was really good. His older brother, Peter, was a good guitar player. And he would come over every Sunday, and he would jam in the basement at his mom's house. And he was showing Dick how to play guitar already. So we just kind of glommed into this. And before you knew it, there'd be 8, 10, 12 kids down there. It was like Garageland by The Clash. There'd be like 6 kids waiting to play guitar with one guitar. There'd be like 5 guys waiting to sing with one microphone. And it was just this thing where we were just playing every 3-chord song you could think of. It was truly a garage band, basement band, what have you. But and Richard's older brother would kind of shepherd us. Oh, here's these chords. Why don't you play Walking the Dog? Why don't you play Last Time? Why don't you play every 3-chord song you could think of, whatever. And he could just, then he would just...
How old were you guys at this
we were like
time?
17, 18.
Wow. So was it like 80, 1980?
Yeah, it was 1980. It was very formative. And time. And we knew about punk rock, and we listened to The Clash. And Richard's other older brother had this amazing collection of 45s from the 60s that he'd been a...
Is he the one that got you started? Because you know more about the 60s music than anyone I know.
Well, I already liked it a lot. We already liked it. But Dave, Richard's middle brother, had this collection. He had the Remains, he had the Yardbirds, the Animals, and he kept everything in pristine condition. So we would listen to all these records and then go try to play them. It just kept feeding on itself. You know, one thing would lead to another. But out of that mess of literally 15, 20 kids who would come over and play, this little core group started. And it was Jeff, me, Richard, someone we drafted in on the drums. Once in a while, we'd come upstairs and there'd be like 40 kids outside Richard's house listening to us. You know,
that's awesome.
Yeah, and they'd be like, oh, you guys are the guys, the man. Anyway, this is way back early on. But then Jeff's brother, Neil, is a saxophone player.
And Boys Life.
He got into Boys Life when their original sax player left. I don't know how he knew about Boys Life. They were a name band around, you know, they got played on the radio. And he just came to them and said, I play sax. And the next thing you know, he was in. Anyway, they're from Malden. John Surrett in Boys Life knew Dennis, who was just learning to play drums. And in fact, Robert Wiener, Boys Life's drummer, was teaching him. They were all buddies. So we needed a drummer. We had this guy. Didn't work out. He was Mr. Mod, and we were really Mod when we started. We really loved the jam and all that Mod stuff. And this drummer guy we had, he's a good guy, but he was Mr. Mod, and he turned us on to all this Mod stuff. And then one day, I went over his place, and I looked around, and all the Mod stuff was off the walls, and everything was like pink polka dots and black and white. And he said, hey, man, Mod's out. Rockabilly's in. And I said, I like Gene Vincent and all, but you know what? You're out. I'm sorry, dude. I'm not going rockabilly just because you decided that the Stray Cats are cool. So anyway, we needed a drummer. John Surrett said, hey, I know a drummer. Next thing you know, we're meeting Dennis in Kenmore Square. We'd never met him before. I see this guy in like a Got Milk t-shirt with like black and white two-tone shoes on and this little haircut. I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's the guy. And that was the guy. So that's how we met Denny. We called it the Malden Newton connection, because the next thing you know, Dennis and like all his buddies would be piling in the car and coming down to Rich's house in Newton, which was Party Central.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, we had a whole Malden Newton connection going. Anyway, that's how it started.
And wow. Malden is like famous for so many guys and bands have come from Malden. It's insane.
I used to get on that green line at Newton Highlands and shag it all the way out to Oak Grove, where Dennis lived. Or conversely, he would come all the way out from there just so we could rehearse. And I lived out there with him at his mom's house for a little while. Anyway, 1981, we got Denny, and then very quickly, especially with Boys Life's help, we got a couple of shows. We played at the Underground. We played at Malden High School. It was like the second show we ever played with Boys Life.
I don't know if we talked about that the last time we talked. That's an interesting connection. We might have, because A Change for the Better and 125, that first single, I want to talk to you about this for a second, excuse me, because John Surratt gets the production credit on Change for the Better. I didn't know he even ever produced anything. I saw that online, and I wanted to ask you about that, because you're mentioning John's name. Now, did he actually produce it, or was he just hanging around the studio and got the production credit? No offense, John.
I'll be honest with you. You saw that online?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, my memory is that he was neither. I know he didn't produce it, and I don't remember him being in the studio. That's in error. Wherever you saw that, that's a mistake.
It said that he did the A side and that Eric Stump did the B side from Plan 9.
No, that's wrong. Whoever did the A side was not John Surratt. John was never in the studio with us.
Okay, was Michael Whitaker, Spaceman, doing the engineering?
Yeah, Michael Whitaker was definitely involved, and
they got that part right.
Yeah, Mike, God bless him. Rest in peace, Mike. Mike was another one. He was great to us and really helped us out. But Eric Stumpo from Plan 9 did 125.
Yeah.
Because he
did the B side.
We were
buddies
with those guys also.
I did get that part right. It's funny. I remember when I went to Enigma Records in 84, we ended up signing Plan 9. And so I got to know Eric a little bit from talking to him on the phone. He's a good guy. We have a lot of weird connections, which we're going to be getting to, that we didn't talk about last time. So A Change for the Better, do you remember who recorded that for you?
It was somewhere in Watertown. It was a guy named, I don't remember that much about it. We went to, because we did the two of them separately. Change for the Better was a studio in Watertown, and I don't remember that much. It was a man and a woman. It was Baker Street Studios, maybe, or something, like Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, yeah.
In any event, we were still just figuring out what we were doing. Our reach definitely exceeded our grasp early on. We were trying. It was the three of us. We didn't have keyboards at first. It was just bass, guitar, and drums initially, as it wound up being at the end again. And the middle period of time, we had a couple of keyboard players before we settled on John for a long time.
Right.
Jonathan Sprague, rest in peace, also, before we settled on John. So we were still the three-piece, and we were really learning how to play. And
was Joyce Linehan involved at that point yet?
Joyce, by the time we did the 45, Joyce was, because she hooked that up for us, and she definitely arranged the Stumpo connection. We played with Plan 9. But
she hooked you up with Plan 9.
Well, you know, we started to play some shows with them, but she was like, you know, the straw that stirred that drink and was making those connections for us.
Because she already had a few other bands at that point, right? Wasn't she with the Lemonheads at that point? Or
no,
was,
that came...
Oh, this is before the Lemonheads,
that came
actually
later. So, again, really early, we played a handful of shows, and we got contacted by Joyce. She was the editor of the High School Times newspaper at the time, which was like an Eastern Massachusetts publication that went into high schools.
I got to interrupt you. For people that don't know Joyce Linehan, she ended up being Marty Walsh's right-hand man, who was the mayor of Boston.
Yeah, on
so
the way.
So she started with garage rock.
And she started promoting.
Worked her way up the ladder.
Yeah, she started as the editor of High School Times in a little office in Park Square, in the Park Square building, right? They had a little office. So we went down there. She wanted to interview us for High School Times. So she did. She took our picture. We thought this was the greatest thing ever. She was putting on all ages shows on Sundays at the Channel, Sunday afternoons.
Oh, really?
And she would have like six bands with like a headliner, like Lou Miami or this one or that one. She threw us on a bill. She was managing a band called The Upstart. She's like, want to play a Sunday? We would love to. Man, we thought we died and went to heaven. The Channel packed. The drinking age was 18. All ages, Sunday afternoons, the place would be packed with kids. Packed. Loving every minute of it. You went out there and played. You thought you were a rock star. Boom. I was like, it's this easy? You know, we played the Underground, we played a few No Glory shows, but all of a sudden it was just like, wow, there's a whole crowd, there's all these other bands playing. So it was great, and that's how we met Joyce. And then she said, I want to manage you guys. We said, sure. So that
so
was
you
how
were
we
technically
started.
Our second band. You mentioned the Upstarts. I remember them.
Yes. And then before too long, she was managing the Unattached from Worcester as well.
Oh, yeah.
So she was, you know, she was laying
the
groundwork.
And then the Lemonheads and Del Fuegos, too? Did she?
No, but she managed a number of other people, Lemonheads, worked with various people, and went on to running First Night, you know, for the city and then in the Walsh administration. So, yeah. Yeah, she did better than any of us, and that, as far as I guess. So, but that's how we met Joyce, and that's how we started playing around. Also, Joe Casey, who was managing Boys Life in the Neighborhoods.
Yeah,
you know.
Oh, I didn't
us.
Know he had Boys Life too. Yeah. It's funny. Just one more thing about Joyce that it's funny. I remember one of the first things she did was she had a Riot Girl Day in Boston. One day there was an announcement. The mayor announces a Riot Girl Day. I'm like, that's got to be Joyce Linehan, man.
Yeah, Joyce worked hard. Joyce was a hard worker, and she really got out there. She was in the studio actually with them. She was in the studio with us and Eric Stumpo.
I mentioned Spaceman too, Michael Whitaker, yeah. R.I.P. Because when I went to L.A. years and years later, my only major label job at A&M, Michael Whitaker was in the art department at A&M. And we're like, look at us now, dude. And the last time I'd seen him was at the Club Lingerie in Hollywood. He showed up at the Neighborhood Show in 1985. But he was a cool guy to have in the
Mike
mix.
Was a character, and at some point we had recorded... Maybe it was the EP version of Where It's At, but we had a recording of Come to Where It's At. And Mike told me one day, he's like, yeah, he was involved in the recording. He's like, I took that recording and I remixed it, or he did something, and he took it down to Lansdowne Street on dance night. And he had some whole like 10-minute dub version of Come to Where It's At, you know, like
with
breakdowns. This was like early 80s, so it was like that kind of thing. But he's like, yeah, I really got people out on the dance floor. And I was like, it's probably better than the goddamn straight up version we recorded.
God.
You know, we should just use that. But he didn't ask us. He's just like, yeah, I did this. We were like, okay, great. That's how it was, you know, back then.
Before we talk about the Matters of Time EP, we have to go back and talk about this again. I know you're going to love this. I was working at DJM in Framingham, and they asked me to be a judge in the Battle of the Bands in 1983 at Jasper's in Somerville, which I don't even know what is that. I don't even remember what Jasper's was. It was in Union Square. That's all I remember.
Somerville Ave. Yeah, it's where Lily's was later.
Oh, it was way up there.
Yes, right on Somerville Ave.
Wow.
I'm pretty sure.
Anyway, the Prime Movers were in it. I got to be you guys won that night. But you beat this Southern rock band, right? And I had to run out of the club because they were going to kill me. And I guess you guys ended up brawling with them after I left.
It was close. We were not the brawling type for the most part. Maybe Denny with a little firewater. But these were some big bearded... Southern rock.
They didn't
guys.
Like losing.
Oh, they were pissed off. That was another really early show. We were still figuring out what we were doing. We really had no clue. Joyce got us in this Battle of the Bands, you know, so whatever. We had no expectation of winning anything.
I don't remember who the other two judges were, but we all voted for the Prime Movers. I know that because you guys won.
Yeah, we won, but somebody didn't like it, and the vibe was thick over there. It wasn't like The Rat or anything. You know, they weren't like looking for punk rock bands or even like... You know, whatever, garage punk rock.
It was dangerous enough in that neighborhood at that time. You'd go outside and you never know some local thug would beat you up or whatever, you know. And I was just a college kid, so.
Yeah. Yeah, that was funny. That was our introduction to Somerville. And we didn't play a lot of shows in Somerville, coincidentally. You know, you didn't get over the line that much back in the day.
It's the first time I saw you guys. I saw you guys later than that at other venues around town. Maybe Jack's, Rat. I don't know, yeah. It was 83. It was a busy time for you guys.
Well, we got our comeuppance not long after. It was when we played the Rumble and lost to Digny Fignus. So,
oh, yeah, right.
So, well, we got ours, you know.
God, I used to have a Digny Fignus shirt, but I don't have it anymore. Yeah. I used to have one. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so Chuck Warner, he somehow comes into the mix. How did he get in the mix? Did Joyce bring him over to you guys?
So, you know, that guy Dave, I don't know if you know Dave Bass. Dave was the one that put out the 45 Change for the Better.
Yeah.
And he had his record label kind of, you know, not occasional release mostly. So he did that for us. But then Chuck just materialized as someone who started a label. He saw these bands in town and this and that. And he was entrepreneurial.
And, nobody gets on the guest list.
Yeah, so he was starting this label, and he started out with the comps.
Yeah, you know? They were great.
And the Nobody Gets on the Guest List comp, it was great. I don't remember if we recorded in a matter of time before, and we're looking for a place to put it. We might have just recorded it anyway, but anyway, it got on the Nobody Gets on the Guest List comp, and that compilation was loaded with Flies and Turbines. And,
oh.
And it got a lot of college radio airplay, and Matter of Time got a lot of college radio airplay, and it was great. It really helped us out.
It found me in California, because when I was at Enigma, we had copies of it. We were listening to all the bands on there. It was a great... He put two of them out, comps.
He put three, actually. But
three.
In any event...
I got to get the third one.
We recorded the, what was that one called? Jaws, Claws.
I probably have them all. I just forgot. But I remember Nobody Gets on the Guest List was great.
But we recorded the one track, and it was good. It was a big improvement over the 45 as far as our time in the studio and knowing what we were doing, etc. And then you did the other one, True to Me, and that worked out well, too. And then at some point, he decided... that he wanted to sign bands and put out, you know, so he was going from the comps too.
Yeah.
And he settled on us. Joyce kind of sold him on us because he believed that we had like a built-in audience and we were already an experienced band. We were playing around for a couple of years.
Yeah, 2 years experience.
Well, we were experienced playing live or whatever, but if you ever saw us live, you know, it was an energetic mess a lot of the time. So you get in the studio and... you're looking to record not just one track. We go in the studio and we could get one track out, and you know, that was fine. It could be a bit of an ordeal, but we could get. If you go in and all of a sudden we're trying to do six, it was beyond our ability, really, and it was hard. The EP sessions were tough. We weren't really ready. We didn't really know. We didn't have a clear idea what we wanted to do. So we went into that situation, and all of a sudden it was hard, and nobody was really happy with the results, and so. All of a sudden, it was a bit of a stall, you know? The two comp tracks had been great and had done a lot for us. The EP was an ordeal. It was an ordeal to record it. It was an ordeal to get it out. And when it came out, nobody was really thrilled with it. And the reception it got was okay.
There is a famous quote of yours that I found. Ready? Quote, Pat D'Annunzio came in to help out and did a good job of rescuing things, although his chain smoking bugged me so much I could bear the thought of signing his band The Smithereens. And when I saw that...
I think that's Chuck.
Oh, Chuck said that? That's not your quote?
That's not... No, that's not my quote. Plus, if he said I couldn't bear the thought of signing his band The Smithereens, that would be Chuck.
Well, it's really funny because, you know, I was at Enigma and we signed The Smithereens. When I saw that, I was like, oh, great. We signed them. They didn't care about... Oh, so Chuck wrote that. Yeah, that makes sense.
So
the thought of signing his band. Yeah, okay, I get it now. I don't know why I thought that was your quote. But so how did Pat get involved?
So we had a friend who was going to Berkeley for engineering and sound, and he engineered the sessions for us, found the studio and engineered the sessions, our friend Scott Konzelman. And when the mixes were done, when he mixed down what we'd done, Chuck and Joyce said no. They weren't happy with it. Things were getting a little frayed here. You know, people were getting a little, and I don't remember everything. There wasn't always a lot of clear discussion. I don't remember anyone coming to me directly and saying, we're not happy with Scott's finished product. What would you like to do? Decisions were made. Sometimes without us. In any event, they didn't like the finished result, and Chuck and Joyce made the decision to bring someone else in. So I always, and yet if you go online and read Chuck Warner's own recollections, he'll say that Andy Paley, who produced True to Me for us in the studio, we did True to Me with Andy from the Sidewinders and the Paley brothers. He was a friend of Chuck's. I've seen Chuck say that it was Andy Paley too. So I don't know.
Your story, his story, and the real story
there's other places where Chuck says it's Pat. In any event, my recollection is Pat came
so
in.
So did you meet Pat at that time?
No. They didn't. They didn't have us at that point. We weren't involved. They didn't bring us in. They did this without us, which honestly, I wasn't crazy about. I didn't like that. They pulled Pat in. Nobody said anything to me or us, as I know Pat D'Annunzio is going to come in and remix everything. They did it themselves. They made the decision. My understanding was Pat literally came in at like 6 o'clock on a Tuesday and got on the last plane back to New York at like 12 midnight. Not really a conducive atmosphere, I wouldn't say, towards, you know. It was rushed. It was done quickly. It was behind schedule. It was a bit of a mess. It was a difficult birth.
Right.
But we squeezed something out.
Well, you got it out.
We got it out.
It did get you a lot of attention because Come the Where It's At was on that, and that got a lot of college radio playing. A lot of attention at that time.
I would say, like, after all the time that went by, like, at the time we were pretty disappointed in some ways. I would say, looking back on it now, you know, it's what it is. It's better than nothing. It's got its moments. But it felt really, really good to get that CD done with Younger all those years later and really get a good, solid representation of the band. I will say that.
And then, so before we get to that, because there's a lot of time in between that period of time, how long was the band still around and active before you finally just called it quits?
I believe the EP was like 85, 84, 85. And we were playing a lot of shows and we were getting a lot of good, you know, the Globe was good to us. So we were getting a lot of good response. But we, 84, 85, 86 were really good years. We were busy, strong, we were touring. But 87, by the end of 87 or late 87,
was there just not a label or another opportunity for another record?
So the EP didn't really do us favors as far as it didn't parlay into another deal like Beyond Throbbing Lobster, which is very local, you
right?
know? And so we were hoping to make the step, and Joyce was hoping to make the next step to an Enigma slash a Twin Tone or something. The EP wasn't. I think the EP hurt us and. For whatever reason, we couldn't get the next deal, the next step. And it just wore the band down, frankly, you know? We could play. We could go to New York. We could play The Rat. We could go on tour. We burned a lot of bridges. Our relationship with Chuck wasn't great after the EP. Our relationship with Joyce wasn't great. At some point, we fired her. So the last, like, year and a half, we were booking ourselves.
You fired Joyce Linehan?
We had a falling out with Joyce. Yeah. There were issues. And so, but you know, mostly it was the grind of trying to get to that next step and doing it and watching other people and frustration and what do we do next? And you know how it is. It's the same with a lot of bands. The time wore us down. It ground us down. People's musical, like, you know, some of the guys started to have other musical interests they wanted to look into.
Yeah, I know you guys ended up splitting into two separate bands.
Yeah, various dynamics. And it's not unusual. You know, you put a lot of years and a lot of hours out of every day in those years into it. And we really kind of lived, slept, ate, and breathed the Movers for several years.
Plus that time, you know, maybe you can touch on this a little bit. It was a really, really busy time in Boston. There were a million bands, a million venues, bands getting signed left and right.
That's the thing. I mean, if you wanted to be all in with it, so to speak, and consumed, you could be. There were a million bands. There were a million places to play. There were a million opportunities if that's what you wanted to do. And we would, I mean, we'd play a set and then jump in the car and go across town to see somebody else playing somewhere else. And then we'd come back to see the last band, you know. Then we'd go to a party, a loft party afterwards. So, yeah, we'd play three or four nights a week sometimes. We'd play constantly every weekend. That's what we wanted to do. You know, I remember back then, my mindset was like the band's first, you know.
Were you guys making any money when you were playing gigs?
You know, money. Not really. I mean, money in my pocket, no. Although I was always willing to sacrifice my job to go to a gig where we'd be lucky to get $30. But I remember I woke up one morning and I was like, shit, we're supposed to go to Portland. I'm supposed to work till this time. I called work. I was like, you know, I can't make it in. They're like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, I can't make it in now. They're like, well, you're fired then. I'm like, okay, see you later. I was just like, I can get another job, but I'm playing the show. We got in the van to go to Portland. The fucking van... The gosh darn van broke down. Excuse me. The gosh darn van broke down halfway to Portland. Never made the show. Lost my job. I woke up the next morning and said, I don't give a damn. I'll get another job. So we kept playing.
That sounds like 1986.
Yeah, I think it was like 1984. But
okay.
But it might as well have been 1986. I would have had the same mindset then. Yes, it was very busy. And it was a competitive scene, too. It wasn't... I mean, you had your friends. Not everybody. But it wasn't... All warm, fuzzy, lovey-dovey.
Oh, I remember. I was working at Enigma at the time, and I signed a few Boston bands, so I used to come to town a lot, and it was like you'd have six bands at The Rat and like four over at Storyville, and you could see like 10 bands in one night, and there was like the punk scene, hardcore, garage, you know, Till Tuesday. I mean, there was so many different things going on.
But it wasn't just like, oh, we're all having a good time and partying together. There was a competitive edge.
Yeah.
And people were looking to get their band in to this spot, whatever it might be, before the other band could get in there. And there were 150 bands behind them waiting to get in too. And so there was always a lot of, you know, and you'd see guys out and you'd see people out and you'd be like, hey, how you doing and this and that. But you were also looking to get your band in there first, because if you didn't, somebody else was going to. It wasn't necessarily personal. It was very competitive.
Yeah, you mentioned Boys Life helping you out before, and I love that story because I was a huge Boys Life fan at that I found her still one of my favorite Boys Life songs ever. The single was great. Were there other bands that you guys were close to at that time that you did a lot of shows with?
Yeah, I mean, through Boys Life, the neighborhood some. I remember Dave talking to us and giving us advice and, you know, telling us, oh, King of the World's a great song, even if it's a complete rewrite of Sorrow by the Mersey Beats. And and the Outlets, you know, we really loved the Outlets, and we used to play with them, and Rick and Dave were good guys. We were kind of contemporaries, or like those guys were already kind of established bands.
I believe I was at an Outlets Prime Mover show at the Rat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But those guys were like established bands when we got there that we kind of looked up to.
Yeah.
Then we were kind of contemporaries with like the Twigs, Dogmatics. But we were also rivals at the same time,
yeah.
You know? So we were friendly, but it was like, well, we're friendly, but if we can get that gig instead of them first, we're getting that gig, you know? Too bad. And that's just how it was. So you had bands that helped us out, certainly to some extent. As soon as we got up on our feet and running, though, you know, those bands were busy also trying to get themselves where they wanted to get to. So there was only so much help and time for helping out that could be done. It wasn't all that altruistic or whatever, you know. And the people like Joe and those guys were there to help. They were also, you know, it was something for them, too. Joan Martin, though, who booked Lou Miami, who managed the
November
Miami.
November group.
She helped Joyce a lot very early on when we were starting out. She was someone that helped a lot, too. So, yeah, certainly.
I think she had the Dangerous Birds, too, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that's people like Joyce, though, they were better than we were. They had more charm or something. They had more of an idea of what was going on. Like, they were better at kind of seeding those relationships, where we were just kind of just chuckleheads. We were just looking to have a good time. We kind of blunder into any situation and, you know, left to our own devices, we might put somebody off or be too obnoxious or something. So it was almost like we were like, you know, had to be babysat a little bit.
I don't want to go right over, you know, you had success with another band, you know, for a while and stuff. But what brought you guys back around 2006 and decided to, like, make what I think is an amazing record, Back in Line? Was there someone's, whose idea was it to reform? Because it was the original band, basically.
It was
minus
the
keyboard
band.
Player, right?
There'd been a little get-together in 1995 for a brief period without Denny, because he was in Los Angeles at the time.
But he was doing the Ape Hangers.
Yeah.
We were at A&M together. Yeah, right.
But the phone rang, and it was Richard, and he was in 95, and he was like, hey, not doing anything, basically, let's get back together. And we got back together with another drummer, Bruce Pierce, who played in the Voodoo Dolls, but John and everybody, and we played for a little while, and we recorded a 45, that Jay Allen had a record label briefly put out. In any event, though, it was short-lived for various reasons. Again, we came back together because they wanted to. Dick wanted to. He was the instigator there, or the initiator. And it was short-lived. Some time went by. My phone rang again, 2001. It was Richard. Let's do a one-off. He was working at the Middle East by then. I think Upper Crust was playing New Year's Eve. He wanted, you know, he had an opportunity to get on the bill, and he saw an opportunity. He said, hey, Prime Movers Union, meant to be a one-off. I said, sure.
New Year's Eve opening for the Upper Crust?
Yeah, and
there
might have been another band there, too. Yeah, but so we got together. Dennis got into town. We rehearsed a couple times, and we pulled off a set. It was a little sketchy, actually, as I remember. At that point, I hadn't sang for several years, and certainly hadn't thought about the Movers for a long time, but we pulled it together. But then, like I say, from there, it just kind of accidentally fed on itself. We did another one somewhere because it was okay and we had fun. And then we started getting calls, you know, hey, you want to play here, you want to play there. And it through 2002, 2003, Dennis was in the process of coming back from LA anyway. He might have been living in Worcester for a little while. In any event, suddenly he was local and it made it easier and we weren't doing anything else. So we just started to play. And then, you know, after we started getting calls and having fun with it, we were playing at the Overdraft kind of regularly for a little while. And then I just started calling some people, and it kind of just fed on itself. We played plenty of humdrum shows, though, even like 2004, 2005. you know, we wanted to play, so we'd get on a bill. We guess on there might be it might be a good show. It might be really poorly attended too. We played plenty of No Glory shows with the Radio Knives and other people who are good bands, but you know, it wasn't like, oh boy, the Prime Movers, wow, like the Beatles are back or something, like, you know, or anything. We had some good shows and some not so good shows. In any event, though, we got hooked up with Jack Younger, who had the studio over on Cambridge Street, and we said, you know, one thing we could be doing with our time instead of playing all these half-hour shows is make a good record. So let's. What about we go in and record? We had some money built up, so we went in and we recorded. Jack had this amazing studio in his apartment on Cambridge Street, right in Lower Alston, right by Frog Legs Liquors and the gas station there.
Frog Legs Liquors.
And you go, it was this gratty kind of looking old apartment building, and you go in the back in the alley into his place, which was basement level, and man, it was quite a little den he had going in there, and he had a beautiful studio loaded with instruments and everything.
Yeah.
And Jack, it's funny, Jack and I had kind of a Glyn Johns, Steve Marriott relationship, i.e., we weren't necessarily really each other's kind of guys for whatever reason, but as far as the recording itself and this and what the job he did, I can't praise Jack enough. Jack was fantastic.
And it's a great record. You know, I spent a few weeks up to this interview listening to that record again.
So
really good.
I'll be honest, I don't like to listen to myself. I've really never enjoyed listening to the music I made. I'll blast one out, you know, spin the 45 or something and go, okay. But that CD, I was really proud of it, and I could just put it on and listen to it, the whole band. Jack was like the extra member of the band. He sang backgrounds, he played keyboards, and he was just an absolutely inspired producer. And he really made it. I mean, honestly, all credit goes to Jack.
And, you know, so you redid Come to Where It's At,
like,
and I thought
the it was, fifth time or something.
Well, on that version, you know what I did the other day? I found the original version on YouTube, and I had the new one, and I listened to them together, and the guitar is what really stuck out for me.
Yeah.
The guitar playing is unbelievable. I wish Dick was here so I could tell him his face. The guitar playing on that remake of it was, I usually don't like remakes. Like when I was working with the Hoods and they wanted to redo Prettiest Girl, I was against the idea. They ended up doing it. It's not as good as the original. You guys, though, on the other hand, I think the new version is better than the original version.
I think so too. We never really squeezed out the right full length recording when we were younger. It was just beyond us. Frankly, it was just beyond our reach at the time. And so there's a version on that, a comp called Battle of the Garage Bands 2 that was actually it's not very good. So I would agree with you. It's much better. And I have to say that I also feel when I listen to the CD that Come to Where It's At, Dick's really popping on that, on Come to Where It's At, and his guitar solo is stupendous. And I've told him so. Like, man. And in fact, my daughter, who's now 20, a year or two ago, put Come to Where It's At out there on social media for a bunch of her friends and people she knows, and some and a bunch of these like 18 to 20 21 year olds were like, what's this? And wow, this is bumping.
It's amazing.
And this and that, and we're like, damn, we're too late, 20 years too late. But it got a nice response from some people. So anyway, it felt really good to get that done. It was a little bit of an ordeal at times too, but by and large it was a really great experience. And made getting back together, whatever else ups and downs might have been, made it worth it, because it felt really good to have that.
And you know, the saying in rock and roll is you got to have a really great singer and a great drummer to have a great band. And you know, we'll talk about the drummer first, okay? Dennis McCarthy, who I got to work with for many years. The Keith Moon of our era, you know? The guy's just phenomenal. Playing is incredible. And you're singing. Is fantastic as well. So you guys together with a really good bass player and Dick's guitar playing, you guys are like a great band.
Thank you.
And it's sad that Jeff Sugarman's not here for the reunion, but Greg seems to be a good guy that's fit in with you guys, and I know you're going to be able to. I want to also mention from that 2007 album that I didn't mention that my favorite song on it is actually Chemical Reaction. I love that song. Oh. The ending is really bizarre. I don't know. Talk about that song and how you came up with that ending.
You know, that song,
like, there's another vocal besides yours at the end.
Yeah, that's some of Jack's trickery, I think. And
is it your vocal being done differently?
I'm not sure.
We have a pregnant pause in the studio here, folks.
A blank
if
look.
You're wondering what the dead air is, it's a pregnant pause.
Does a blank look in the eyes come across on the radio?
Well, I love it, whatever the heck it is, man.
That was some of Jack's trickery, I suppose. That was a riff that Dick had, and I was writing a lot of the lyrics at some point for some of the songs. When he's down, say those words. A few of those songs, I wrote the lyrics to Chemical Reaction. It was just some 20-something angsty BS, but it fit the vibe. And the thing about that song was when we were learning it, we were wrestling with what tempo to play it, so it didn't sound too much like. Tonight is gonna be a jailbreak. You know, we were like, oh man, we don't want to tread too much into this territory. So that was one thing that I remember when we were first coming out with working on Chemical Reaction. Somebody was like, this sounds like Thin Lizzy. And we were like, well, we don't want that. What can we do here? And then some friends of ours, these guys, the Juice Men from New Jersey, they covered Chemical Reaction. You can find it on
YouTube. They did.
You can find it on YouTube. And what they did, they sped it way the F up. They sped it way the hell up and just like banged it out super garagey. And it's awesome. I was like, damn, that's how we should have done it. The Juice WRLD version is great. So if you ever want to check it out, if you like the song, check out the Juice WRLD version.
You could find the record, the 2007 record, all over online everywhere. I don't know if you probably could buy it somewhere. I said 2007, but it was six actually. Back in line.
You could buy it from me because I have approximately 500 in my pantry. Or you could come to the Burn Saturday, September 14th. We'll be giving them away. If you pay to come in, you get a CD.
Cam with the brilliant segue, so I didn't have to. September 14th, the Burn. Okay, you got the Sonomatics opening from Western Massachusetts.
Two E's. Super fun band.
Kind of like the Head Coatees.
Exactly. Yeah.
Who I happen to love.
Without the British accent. No, they're great guys. They're a lot of fun. The whole night's going to be a blast. 6 to 9. At the Burn, so all the old timers can get home, plenty of time to rest, including myself.
I see you looking at me when you said old timers. It's okay.
I'm looking right at you, Daddy. But I'm also looking right at myself.
Well, you know, thank you, man, so much for coming on. Cam Acklin.
Oh, Steve, thanks
Prime
for having
Movers.
Me. My pleasure. Always a pleasure.
All right. You can reach me anytime, by the way, at twistedrico@gmail.com. We have Facebook, Threads, Instagram, YouTube. Actually, we have a YouTube page, but there's no video on this one. Probably thankful for the way I look after I rolled out of bed this morning. Trudging.
Likewise.
You know, getting out here to Medvid, you know. But it's worth it. It's worth it, Mike Newman. It's worth it. We also have a Patreon page, patreon.com/TwistedRico. If you can't do that right now, just tell one person about this podcast, and we can continue to grow this baby organically. All right. Till the next time we say goodbye, this is Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. Keep the rock and roll alive.
Yeah.
And for you WMFO listeners, here's a couple of great tunes by the Prime Movers.
All the games we're playing, satellites are
WMFO Medford, 9:49 in the morning. I'm Mike. How you doing? Thanks so much to Steve and to Cam for that great live edition of Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. That'll be out on the podcast soon. Steve usually gets it out within a couple of weeks, so look for that. And we just heard a couple of extra songs by the great Prime Movers that won't be on the podcast. That was both from the album that Steve was talking about, Back in Line, from 2006-2007. First was Chemical Reaction, and then we just heard Where It's At. All right, in the second hour, I have a great New York power pop band coming up called the Midnight Callers. They're here. They're going to play three songs. I'm going to play a bunch of stuff of theirs, and we're going to actually hear some stuff live from them as well. They've got two new tracks too that we'll hear. But until then, I'm going to play some tunes for you, starting off with local band. Thanks to Michael Morata for this one. This is the great Lovina Falls and Ellery Way to start us off at WMFO.
When the halo of the night is peeking through the trees, knowing that we've got nowhere else we've got to be, and the freedom of the sky is higher than we dare. Forget ourselves for once or for twice as if we care. We're floating. As we go, there is nothing we can fear. As the air above us hums and the earth below us hears, and the shadow in the grass paints a picture of a star. With 100 tiny lights, when you see it from afar, we're floating.
reading. This can't keep going on. I keep writing words to the same song.
This is more like it.
You're listening to WMFO Medford.